Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 28th, 2015. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How you doing, D.R.?
Good. How you doing?
Good. And we're pleased to have a special guest today, Mr. Taylor Garr, who spends most of his days teaching science to 5th and 6th graders, but he does also the important work of volunteering with the Greater Boston Move to Amend. So we will talk about exactly what that means, but welcome, Taylor. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Ted. Good, glad to be on. Thanks.
Great. So just as a little bit of background to put you in the right mood, most people are aware that the Supreme Court within the last couple of years has made several interesting decisions as they relate to corporate, the nature of corporations in the United States. One of the most important ones was a decision that's typically called Citizens United. And within that Supreme Court ruling, which basically is the final law of the land, within that Supreme Court ruling, the Supreme Court basically said that corporations are people, believe it or not, and that they have the same free speech rights as other human beings. And of course, that's caused a lot of consternation. And I think that that's one of the impetuses for Taylor's volunteer work. So tell me, Taylor, did I get the story about Citizens United correct? And what kind of stuff have you been doing?
Yeah, so you described pretty well sort of the popular line about Citizens United, what most people know about it. It actually goes a lot deeper than that, and you know, you can get pretty far into the legal weeds if you try to figure out exactly what the decision came down to. But the idea that corporations are people is a very old idea. Where that factors into this decision is that the Supreme Court has said for over 100 years now, they have built this doctrine of saying that corporations not only are people in the sense that they can enter into contracts and sue and be sued, which is actually a really important part of what it means to be a corporation, but that they actually can claim constitutional rights. So as you said, the same free speech rights as you and I. And Citizens United itself actually had more to do with a second Supreme Court doctrine, sort of a second idea that goes back to the 1970s, this idea that money is speech, that if you try to put limitations on the way that money is raised and spent in our elections, that's somehow violating the First Amendment by blocking people's political speech. So that's actually the principle that Citizens United came down on more than anything else. But
sort of facilitated this whole thing of corporations having freedom to spend money in elections, right?
Right. So the takeaway from Citizens United was that corporations and unions, you know, these sort of artificial entities that were not individual human beings but were sort of associations that exist only on paper, were free to spend unlimited amounts of money from their general treasuries, and that a piece of legislation that had been passed in 2003 to try and create some limits on the way that money was raised and spent. It was called the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, known as the McCain-Feingold bill for the two who came together to get it passed. But what that did was it helped to close some of these loopholes where sort of dark money or soft money, money that was harder to trace, less accountable, was flowing into elections. It put a bunch of different limits on that. It also, you know, mandated that when you see a political ad now, they have to say who it was paid for. You know, that's a part of that same act.
The McCain-Feingold bill from 2003. Yep.
Exactly. But so what Citizens United did was strike down a major provision of that, which had to do with limiting, you know, corporations being able to bankroll expenditures, you know, commercials and stuff in right up in the run up to an election.
And so, generally speaking, that's not a very good thing for democracy, right? I guess I would say you see now in some of the people running for president basically have to perform for very, very rich people in order to get donations, right?
And absolutely.
That's an invidious, insidious kind of influence on American politics.
Exactly. It's part of a long-term trend that we've witnessed over decades, but it's really just becoming clearer and more dramatic with each of these successive sort of Supreme Court decisions. And there's actually evidence now. You may remember there was a big study that came out last year by researchers at Princeton and Northwestern. They combed through decades of public policy and the polling that went along with it, and they sort of sliced the data to be able to parse out the opinions of the wealthy, what they termed the economic elite, and then everyone else in society. Mm-hmm. And then they also had a category for interest groups, sort of lobbyists and organizations that are in that business. And what they found was tremendously depressing, which was that the opinions, the preferences of the vast majority of Americans have no statistical impact on what actually becomes law. So whether 10% of Americans are in favor of something or 90% of Americans are in favor of it, it has the same likelihood of becoming law. But when you parse out the preferences of just the rich, you actually see a tremendous responsiveness. So if there's a policy that is backed by the wealthy, that's in their interest, it's very likely to become law. And if it's something that they're dead set against, it basically has no chance of passing. So
yeah, and I guess the big example for in the climate realm is the Koch brothers, right? I mean, they seem to have an unlimited amount of money, and now they're able to spend it as they would like, right? And there are certainly examples on both sides of the aisle of where money is being spent to influence politics, right? But most people are familiar with the Koch brothers, right?
Sure. And so the situation we have is that the most influential players in the economy become the ones who are directing the political process. And so you look at where money and power and influence is concentrated, and we've seen just a continuing consolidation over the past few decades. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that jumps out is the energy sector, and it's these – I mean, the most profitable corporations on the planet are the oil and gas companies. And so they do have a tremendous amount of resources with which to manipulate the political system, and so the system that we're operating under, partly thanks to these Supreme Court decisions, really enables them to have almost total.
And just, I mean, it's an interesting point, because I was reading a New Yorker article a few years ago talking about how when ExxonMobil, an oil company, puts a well into the ground, they have a 10, 20, 30-year horizon, right? And they're planning that far out, and they have the money to make that plan, whereas most politicians are always focused on the next two-year election. So just the time scales are so different that the corporations have a huge advantage in influencing. But let me ask this then. So we've painted what you might think is a dismal picture of American politics, a sclerotic and unhappy kind of deal. What can be done about it?
Sure. So the good news is there is a rapidly growing, what I like to just call the democracy movement, across the country right now. Since the Citizens United decision, just in the last 4 or 5 years, you've seen activists spring up all across the country to address this, and we've managed to get 16 states now, just in the last few years, to either through state legislature or through a statewide ballot initiative to go on record asking Congress for a constitutional amendment. So when the Supreme Court makes a ruling, creates this doctrine that becomes legal precedent, as they have with the idea that corporations have constitutional rights and that money is speech, the only way that you can
I mean, those things have constitutional force, Right.
Right.
Those rulings are the law of the land.
Right. So there's only one way to fix that, only one way to supersede it, and that's through a constitutional amendment. And that's something that is both tremendously difficult to do and utterly possible. Right. We've seen 27 amendments. You know, the first 10 were the Bill of Rights, but 17 times since then it has been amended. Every generation until mine has experienced a movement that created a constitutional amendment, and that's
just to make sure. So what we're talking about here is an amendment to the Constitution equivalent to, say, the Equal Rights Amendment in the 70s, or the amendment that limited term limits for presidents in the 1950s. I mean, this is a thing that would be, you know, inscribed, you know, in the Constitution, right?
Sure. Yeah. So I like to draw parallels to amendments that were the direct result of people coming together and creating movements that were so broad and so vibrant that they became the impetus for this dramatic level of change. You look at the abolition movement, which led to the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. You look at the women's suffrage movement, which created an amendment. And actually, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, one of the big areas of focus for sort of progressive reformers at that point was that the U.S. Senate was essentially a good old boys club. It was a very corrupt and undemocratic system where the state party machinery would nominate senators. So you got to vote for your – well, at that point, if you were a man, you got to vote for your representative in the House, but not for your senator. So for decades, reformers pushed to try and make this system more democratic, and the House of Representatives actually proposed an amendment to the Constitution and passed it a number of times. But the Senate didn't want to change the way they had gotten there, right? Bite the hand that feeds them. So they just stonewalled for decades. And what it took was activists in the states organizing at the local and state level to pass resolutions that put the states on record calling for what's called an amendments convention.
And this is, let me stop you there.
Yeah.
You're going to explain the constitutional mechanism for,
sure,
you know, how amendments are made law?
Sure. So Amendments 101 is every amendment that we've had so far, the 27 amendments to the Constitution, have followed one of the two routes that were set out in the Constitution. They have followed this first route of Congress proposes an amendment, and then the states ratify it. So an amendment has to be voted on by the House and the Senate, has to pass by a two-thirds majority, and then that sends it out to the states, and three-fourths of the states have to ratify it. That's how it's always been done so far. But with the direct election of senators, the story that I was getting into, we actually saw as leverage, we saw the use of the other path that the Constitution sets out. So the second option is – and there's actually evidence. There's notes from the convention in Philadelphia that the framers were sitting around going, well, wait a second. What if Congress is the problem, right? If you're waiting for an amendment to come out of Congress, to be proposed by Congress, you need some sort of safety mechanism here, a sort of backstop for democracy. And so what they built in was a route where the states can actually go around Congress. And it's called a convention of the states or an amendments convention under Article 5 of the Constitution. So what happened in the early 1900s was that states started calling for a convention, basically saying, all right, Congress, if you're not going to do anything, we're going to go around you. We're going to go over your head and do it ourselves. And they got to within one state of the threshold. You need two-thirds of the states to call a convention. And there were two states that were about to join the union. They were poised to actually trigger their convention. And lo and behold, the Senate said, oh, you know what? Actually, we want to take over from here. We'll handle this. We hear your demand. We will pass this amendment because we want to control the process. And so it was the leververage that that actually forced this recalcitrant, corrupt.
And that leverage was individual activists in the different states driving their state to call for the amendment, right?
Exactly. And so that's what we're seeing happen today. I think I mentioned that Massachusetts is one of 16 states now that has said, hey, Congress, we want you to pass an amendment to fix these disastrous Supreme Court rulings. Mm-hmm. Congress, I think anyone who thinks that Congress is going to listen to the states and do anything about it anytime soon is delusional. And so given the Congress that we have right now, and the fact that they are at the heart of the problem that we're trying to fix, states have begun sort of pulling out the big guns, turning to this second mechanism. And so in the last few months, we've seen four states kind of up the ante by calling for a convention: Illinois, New Jersey, Vermont, and California. And so you mentioned at the beginning when you introduced me that I volunteer with a group called Move to Amend. I'm with the Greater Boston affiliate. We've got sort of local groups all across the Commonwealth working on this issue. We are part of a movement that's growing to try to add Massachusetts to that list of states that are sort of in the vanguard here. As the cradle of American democracy, we really feel like it's a sad state of affairs when Massachusetts is not stepping up and helping to take the lead with this. And so we've built a coalition of different groups across the state, many of whom have done great work on climate specifically. You know, we've got MassPerg on board with this coalition. We've got the Sierra Club of Massachusetts endorsing a piece of legislation that's now in the Massachusetts legislature.
And so, if I could just interrupt for one second there, that you touched a very good point. The reason that you are talking about this on a climate change podcast is because of the recognition that corporations are basically controlling the climate debate and preventing anything, preventing progress. And this is one more front in the climate war, is to take out the bad guys this way, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the obstacles to effective action on climate are clear, and a lot of them have to do with consumer habits that are a result of misinformation and sort of general lack of understanding of the science. But there are some very concrete obstacles that boil down to the way the political system is structured right now, and the fact that the people who are working in the interest of the public good do not have the power to create policy.
So I interrupted you. You were talking about the Massachusetts effort to pass at the state level a resolution calling for either Congress to pass an amendment or this Article 5 route, correct?
Right. So this is a bill called the We the People Act, and it was introduced in January. It is in committee now. There will hopefully be a hearing coming up soon. And so I'm here to sort of make the pitch to all of your listeners to learn more about this bill. You can find it at www.wethepeoplemass.org. All the information.
That's MASS. We the People MASS.
Exactly. And so what the bill would do, in a nutshell, is put Massachusetts on record calling on Congress for an amendment that specifically lays out these two principles: that corporations do not have constitutional rights, and that money is not speech in the purposes of elections. But if Congress doesn't act within 6 months, I think we can all agree that Congress is not going to, then the bill turns into an application for an amendments convention. Mm-hmm. So it moves Massachusetts from this group of 16 states that have said, hey, Congress, please do something about this, to the smaller group of states that's now moving forward and saying, you know what, if you're not going to act, we will.
And just in terms of the progress in Massachusetts, my memory in speaking with Chris Manns last fall is that in the 2014 election, there was an advisory question in 16 towns in Massachusetts and to advise in favor of this, and every single one of them passed, right?
Yeah, so that actually happened in 2012 and then again in 2014 in different areas. So the way the process works in Massachusetts is that if it's a resolution that's not creating new binding Massachusetts law, rather than doing a statewide petition and everybody voting on it, you actually work district by district. Mm-hmm. And so we had volunteers out there pounding the streets, collecting signatures in 2012, and we managed to put an advisory question about this amendment in front of about a third of the voters in Massachusetts. And then in 2014, we added another 19 districts that had not had a chance to vote on it in 2012. And the remarkable thing is that this is the same result that we've seen all across the country. Every time there's polling or every time this question is put on the ballot, super majorities of voters say, we support this kind of reform, we support this amendment. In Massachusetts, the average support was 70-something percent in favor, and there was nowhere where it was less than a clear majority.
So what people can do in the near term is to learn, go to We the People, MASS, right? Read about this. There's a bill in the Massachusetts State House. You can call your state rep, right, or your senator, and urge them to vote for it. In particular, I guess, to co-sponsor these things. That's the best thing to request now, right?
Yeah. So here's the status right now is that when it was introduced in January, we through our work getting lobbyists to talk to their legislators, we managed to get fully half of the Senate on board as co-sponsors the day that it was introduced. And if you include the reps in the House, we've got more than 80 co-sponsors. Wow. to this bill. And
just so that people know, again, this idea that if a senator or a representative co-sponsors a bill, they're committed to it, and they are the kind of leading edge. So the more co-sponsors you have, I mean, it's different from actually voting, right? It's like a public sign of support for the bill.
Right. So that goes both ways. Yes, on the one hand, it's a more sort of forceful show of support from a legislator than just waiting and voting yes for the bill is. But the other side of that coin actually is that co-sponsoring does not bind them to actually vote for it. So mm-hmm. So it's sort of an initial show of support, but the really important thing is to keep up pressure on the legislators. They need to hear from their constituents, not only that we want them to support this when it comes up for a vote, but that we want them to make it a priority. Right. Because in the jumble of the legislative process, if something does not have priority among the legislators who are sort of holding positions of power on Beacon Hill, then it's not likely to come up for a vote, even if it has a majority of legislators already co-sponsored, ready to vote for it, right? So what we need to do is really motivate people and mobilize people to continue contacting their reps and saying, we want this to be a priority. We want you to go to the mat for democracy here.
I think that's a great way to leave it. I mean, we gotta quit. But thank you very much to Taylor Garr of the volunteer with the Greater Boston Move to Amend. Very interesting discussion, highly relevant to climate. I'm glad you're able to come on. Of course, when we get closer and there's a vote coming up, we'll have you come back and talk to us some more about the status. Okay?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Ted. I do want to put in one little plug. As people are learning more about the bill, we also have a team of educators who we've developed a workshop that goes into a lot more of the history behind this. There's actually an incredible connection to the environmental movement in the 70s, and a lot of what we're seeing today is kind of a backlash from the success that the environmental movement saw when people were mobilized then. But so we go into a lot of the history and give more information on how to get involved. So if you go to wethepeoplemass.org, there's a way to contact us, and we would be happy to come anywhere in the state and present this workshop for anyone who wants to listen.
That's great. Well, our listeners should know they can check out the links to most of what we talked about here, including the links that Taylor just mentioned at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.wordpress.com. You can leave us a comment. You can share it. You can send us a comment and email us a comment to comment@massclimateaction.net. You can get the show on Facebook. It's /MassClimateAction. You can listen to the show. Please share us. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher. You can find us on iTunes by searching for Mass Climate Action. Please subscribe to us there. It pushes up our visibility and lets other people know about the show. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for being here, Taylor.
Thanks so much for having me, Ted.
And DR, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.